Stay up to date on the biggest issues of the day with the MSNBC Daily Newsletter. Each morning, you'll get analysis by experts you trust, video highlights from your favorite shows.
2024 is now truly the most important election in the history of our country.
Previews of our podcasts and documentaries, plus written perspectives from the newsmakers themselves, all sent directly to your inbox each morning. Get the best of MSNBC all in one place. Sign up for MSNBC Daily at MSNBC.com.
Welcome back to our breaking news coverage here in Washington. We have a lot to get to this hour, including White House National Security Communications Advisor John Kirby, who's sitting right here at the table, ready for me to ask him a lot of questions about the Iranian attack on Israel overnight. And as we count down to the start of the first criminal trial of a former president, Lanny Davis will also join me live later in the hour. He's a legal advisor to star witness Michael Cohen. And Congressman Jamie Raskin is going to be here to weigh in on all of the above and what exactly Speaker Johnson was up to at Mar-a-Lago on Friday. But I do want to start this hour with the breaking news out of the Middle East. Overnight, Iran carried out an hours-long airborne attack against targets inside Israel, launching more than 300 cruise and ballistic missiles and drones. According to the IDF, 99% of the incoming fire was intercepted, in part thanks to the Iron Dome and Arrow 3 defensive systems, largely funded and provided by the United States, and to a coordinated effort by the U.S. and neighboring countries, including Jordan, in the region. Only a few of the more than 100 ballistic missiles launched actually entered Israel, causing minor damage at an Israeli airbase. A young girl was injured by shrapnel, but there were no immediate reports of other casualties. There haven't been at this point in time. Iran says this attack was in retaliation for the Israeli strike on an Iranian consular building in Damascus, Syria, which killed several senior Iranian commanders earlier this month. Now, despite being adversaries for more than 40 years, this does mark the first time Iran has launched a direct attack on Israel from inside their own territory. And for that reason, it is unprecedented. It's important to remember that. Iran also made clear last night through a statement issued by the UN mission that they were done, stating, quote, the matter can be deemed concluded, indicating Iran has no interest, at least that's how I read it, but I'll ask John Kirby in a moment, in escalating war directly with Israel. But the statement also included a not-so-veiled, all-caps warning to the United States, saying it is a conflict between Iran and the rogue Israeli regime, from which the U.S. must stay away. So the big question is, what happens now? Well, last night, the Israeli defense minister made clear the campaign is not yet over. The Israeli war cabinet is meeting as we speak, and we'll bring you any updates we have from that over the next hour. And while President Biden and U.S. officials played a significant role in protecting Israel against the retaliatory strikes from Iran last night, new reporting makes clear patience from the president is not unlimited. As NBC News reports, there is concern among top U.S. officials that Israel could respond too quickly without thinking through the potential fallout. There's also been private frustration with Israel's decision to strike the Iranian consulate in Syria earlier this month, with a senior administration official saying, quote, the Israelis don't always make the best strategic decisions. And according to additional NBC reporting out today, the president told Netanyahu in their phone call to, quote, take the win, and that Israel should not retaliate against Iran, also adding that the U.S. will not participate in offensive operations against Iran. But it remains to be seen whether Netanyahu will show the kind of restraint Biden is calling for. Recent history shows he hasn't exactly listened to all of the recent warnings by the United States, and he has his own domestic audience to consider, especially as he is under pressure to call early elections. At the end of the day, this all further escalates tensions in the region, or it could, at a time when Iranian proxies like Hezbollah were already attacking Israel, including even last night. And at a time when there is a war happening between Israel and Hamas, one that has killed tens of thousands inside Gaza and has left many others starving. Hamas also, again, rejected a ceasefire deal overnight. So the question now is whether Iran's response will trigger additional military action from Israel that could escalate into an uncontrollable cycle of violence, and what the White House and President Biden can do to de-escalate tensions in an already volatile region. Joining me now is White House National Security Communications Advisor John Kirby. So you were there's no one better at explaining all of this. And we'll see what you're going to share with me. But we're trying to help people really understand all of the dynamics here.
Yeah.
So let me just start with the Israeli war cabinet meeting, which is ongoing right now. They're discussing a response to the attack. We haven't heard what they're going to say. I did just quote the Israeli defense minister from last night. It seems like from the reporting, the ideal is to, of course, de-escalate here, de-escalate the tensions here. There's already a lot going on in the region. Is the hope from the United States, even as Israel will make their own decisions, that they don't do a retaliatory strike?
Well, the hope is that we can de-escalate the tensions. That's really what the president's been trying to do, Jen. And I think, you know, from the beginning of October 7th on, everything he's done, all the movements of military assets to the region, all the diplomacy, both public and private, has really been designed to take the tensions down. He doesn't want to see a major war in the Middle East. He doesn't want us not looking for a conflict with Iran. And if you look at last night, Jen, I mean, an incredibly successful evening. Not only did it demonstrate that Israel can feel comfortable that they're not alone, and they're not, but also that they have superior military capability to defend themselves and their citizens. And one of the messages that the president delivered to the prime minister was, you know, be proud of what you were able to accomplish last night, because that itself sent a very strong signal, not just to Iran, but to every other bad actor in the region.
Now, there was a call a couple of weeks ago that the president made with Prime Minister Netanyahu where there was an impact from that call. It seemed like it was a stern call after the death of some aid workers. There was a call yesterday. There hasn't been retaliatory action yet from Israel, though the war cabinet is meeting. Is there any evidence you've seen that they have pulled back, held back, or not moved forward in retaliation from the call the president had with the prime minister?
We haven't seen anything in terms of movement or even, frankly, anything that would indicate they've arrived at a decision. As you said, the war cabinet's still meeting. So obviously we'll see what they end up coming out of that and doing and saying. But again, the president's message was, we've got your back, and we did. We proved it. I mean, the president ordered U.S. forces in the active defense of Israel. And we have sent that same message to Iran, that we will do what we have to do to defend Israel, as well as defend our troops in the region.
There are, I know you're not going to get into private phone calls. I've been in your spot before, a version of it. But, you know, in the reporting, which is widely spread out there, the president conveying to the prime minister, take the win, or that's what he said to him in the call last night. Do you think, I mean, what does the U.S. do? What are the discussions like internally? If Israel retaliates in response, I mean, what additional levers does the U.S. have here? Because the U.S. wants Israel to be protected, to have the defensive systems against Iran. So what can they do if Prime Minister Netanyahu just says, I know you said take the win, I'm not going to do that, I'm going to do additional action?
Well, obviously that would have to be his call. He's the elected prime minister of Israel, so he'll have to make those decisions in concert with the war cabinet. What we need to do, and what we will continue to do, the president will do, is make sure we've got the resources in the region to continue to defend Israel, as we did last night and as we have done since the 7th of October. But also make sure, and we get caught up a lot, and it's easy to, you know, about the troops in Iraq and Syria and the threats from the proxies, and those are real threats. But we also have broader regional concerns there in the Middle East, broader national security interests. And the president is keenly focused on making sure that the Iranians and everybody else knows we take those interests seriously as well, and we'll do what we have to do, and we'll hold Iran appropriately accountable, as we have. The last 3 years, more than 500 sanctions against Iran and their destabilizing activities. So everything from, you know, maritime piracy to beating up on their protesters. So we're going to keep all those options open to us. One of the things the president is doing this morning while the war cabinet's meeting is he convened a meeting of the G7. Leaders of the G7.
About a response.
To talk about a diplomatic response. So there are lots of options here to continue to hold Iran properly.
And let me ask you about that G7 meeting. What does that look like? What is he hoping will come out of that? Is it sanctions? Is it punishment to Iran? Is it something else?
The first big step for getting them together is really to come out with a concerted statement of condemnation for what Iran did last night, and a common path forward on how we're going to deal with this. Now, I wouldn't expect, and we'll see, I'm sure we'll see a readout of the call here soon. I wouldn't expect that there'll be specific sanctions announced, but I'm certainly not going to say that we're going to take economic pressure off the table here on Iran. We'll have to do this in unison with our allies and partners. And again, I think the president wanted to get those G7 leaders together, some of our most important allies and partners, to see what could be in the realm of the possible.
You referenced the proxies. There's a lot of dynamics going on here at play. And I think as people are tuning into this, it's important to understand. I mean, Iran has a significant role in guiding, advising. You can define it any way you want. Proxies like Hezbollah. Hezbollah attacked Israel even last night, even as Iran, through the UN mission, said, we're kind of done here. How do you hold Iran accountable for the actions of their proxies? Do you? And the second part of this is, do you worry that this conflict could give greater cover for some of these proxies to escalate their attacks?
The second question, yes, of course. I mean, these proxies, as you know, yes, they are supported by Iran. There's varying levels of direction that they get from the Supreme Leader and the IRGC, depending on where they are and what the circumstances are. But clearly, look, Iran is supporting them, resourcing them, training them, and in fact, in some cases, giving them direction. But they also can run off on their own a little bit. So yes, we are worried about what the proxies might do. They did get involved to a limited degree last night, more symbolic than certainly militarily effective. But it is an example of what Iran was trying to accomplish, was that this wasn't just Iran going after Israel, but that these other groups were joining it, that there was a bigger effort. Clearly, though, the most important thing was that it was coming from Iranian territory for the first time on Israel.
There have been a number of Republican elected officials, it's far too many in my view, over the last 24 hours, who have called on the president to do proactive attacks against Iran. I mean, Elisa Stefanik did, a couple of senators. Help us understand why that is damaging. I mean, there are U.S. military bases around the world who are a bit under threat now, potentially. Iran mentioned them. The Iranians did in their statement. Give me a response to those statements calling for action from the United States directly at Iran.
I don't think it's in our interest or the American people's interest. The president doesn't believe it, to have another war in the Middle East where you've got thousands and thousands of American troops involved on the ground. And everything he's been doing, as I said, since the 7th of October has been to try to prevent that outcome. And then I would ask those critics to take a look at last night. I mean, my goodness, more than 300 drones and missiles fired at Israel from Iran. And how many made it through? And what damage did they cause? And it was an utter failure from a military perspective and an incredible success from an Israeli perspective. And I think we've got to keep coming back to the end result last night. What was shown the world was that Iran is not 10 feet tall and Israel has friends and extraordinary capability. And as you said in your opening, one of the reasons they have that capability, a big reason, is the United States. So our approach is working.
Let me ask you before I let you go back to your day about how this impacts the war between Israel and Hamas. Because as you know, domestically here, there have been growing calls for conditioning aid. Obviously, some of the same diplomats are dealing with Israel on a range of issues. Earlier, Ben Rhodes, who obviously has spent time in the White House, as you and I have, said it makes it harder to work on that and work toward a deal. What is your assessment of that?
We believe, certainly, look, if you really believe in Israel's future security, then you have to believe in a two-state solution. You have to believe in getting to that vision. And if you believe in that, as the president does, then you've got to believe in the power of trying to get a temporary ceasefire in place so we can get the hostages out, we can get more humanitarian assistance in. And this doesn't become a situation where Israel's reputation on the world stage is damaged to the point, and their credibility is damaged to the point, where this becomes a generational struggle. And that's what we're really trying to get at. There's a deal on the table. Hamas should take it immediately, and it would get, you know, dozens of these most at-risk hostages out. It would get more aid in, and it would give us 6 weeks of some peace and some calm there in Gaza to try to work on something enduring. The president still believes in that. He's not Pollyannish about that. He really does believe that that's the best answer, not just for the future of the Palestinian people, of course, but also for the future of the Israeli people, for their future security.
John Kirby, I know you didn't get a lot of sleep last night. I appreciate you being here and really helping us understand what's happening behind the scenes. Thank you so much for joining me.
Thanks for having me.
And coming up, Congresswoman Alyssa Slatkin is standing by. She's worked at the CIA. She's worked on the National Security Council. And she knows what all of the players involved are weighing as the situation unfolds. And later, we'll shift our focus to what's going to be a very historic day tomorrow in a different way, as Donald Trump's first criminal trial kicks off in New York City. Michael Cohen's legal advisor, Lanny Davis, will be here, and so will Congressman Jamie Raskin. We're just getting started.
Hi, everyone. It's Katie Fang. Did you know my weekly show on MSNBC is now available as a podcast? With my decades of experience as a trial lawyer, you'll get an insider's perspective on all things legal. At a time when politics and the law are inextricably intertwined, my guests and I break down what's next and why it matters, both inside and outside the courtroom. Search for The Katie Fang Show wherever you're listening and follow.
Get the latest updates on this year's high-stakes election with MSNBC's How to Win 2024 newsletter. When you subscribe, you'll get expert analysis on key races sent straight to your inbox, including articles written by the host of the How to Win podcast, Jennifer Palmieri. Subscribe today at MSNBC.com/win.
Part of the hour, and we'll be right back after a quick break. Iran's attack against Israel is sparking new urgency in both parties to pass an aid package to help Israel. And it could happen this week. In a post last night, House Majority Leader Steve Scalise said, quote, in light of Iran's unjustified attack on Israel, the House will move from its previously announced legislative schedule next week to instead consider legislation that supports our ally Israel and holds Iran and its terrorist proxies accountable. But he did not offer any more specifics about the legislation. It's also unclear what that will mean for the $95 billion package passed by the Senate in February that includes aid for Israel as well as Ukraine. Joining me now is someone who knows firsthand how global conflicts are discussed both in the halls of Congress and in the Situation Room, Michigan Congresswoman Alyssa Slotkin. She's a former CIA analyst who served three tours in Iraq. She previously worked in both the Department of Defense and on the National Security Council. Congresswoman, I'm so grateful for you, to you for being with me this morning. I want to start just there with the expected vote that Congressman Scalise announced on aid for Israel. I mean, as I noted, he didn't give specifics. You may have more. Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell yesterday urged the House to take up the Senate passed foreign aid package that includes not just aid for Israel, but also for Ukraine and Taiwan. But Speaker Johnson said this morning that the House will send its own package. So help us understand how this will all play out.
Yeah, honestly, I think my Republican colleagues in the Senate need to have a conversation with the Republican colleagues in the House. the fastest way to get any of this done is to have the Senate package that is already passed on a bipartisan basis in the U.S. Senate that is sitting on Mike Johnson's desk. Just bring it to a vote. We know it will pass. There are enough Democrats and Republicans who will support it that it will pass the second he puts it on the floor. But he's been reluctant to do that because he's had, you know, Marjorie Taylor Greene threatening his job over Ukraine funding. He's just going to have to put on his big boy pants and bring it to the floor and let us vote on it this week. So we're hoping that Mr. McConnell has that conversation with Mr. Johnson.
Put on those big boy pants. There's still a war with Ukraine right now happening. You heard it from Congresswoman Slotkin. Let me ask you about what we've seen over the last 48 hours. Obviously, a lot of events happening. And my colleagues, Carol Lee and Courtney Cuby, have some new reporting about concern among some top U.S. officials that Israel could do something hastily. The War Cabinet's meeting right now could do something to escalate. There are also reports over the past week that Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin was upset that he was not given a heads up about Israel decision to strike the Iranian embassy in Damascus, especially given all the support the U.S. gives. I wanted to just help people understand the dynamics here going on. I mean, obviously, it was a success, a military success overnight to deflect all of these attacks from Iran. The U.S. played a role in that. But do you share this frustration or concern about this potentially escalating from Israel at this point in time and causing a larger global conflict in the region?
Well, look, I mean, Iran's response, I think we need to start with basic facts here, which is Iran's response, what Israel did, is fundamentally different than what we've seen in any other previous attack on IRGC officers, including when the United States of America took out the head of the organization, Qasem Soleimani, a few years ago. Iran did a combined attack with ballistic missiles, cruise missiles, and drones, over 300 of them. This is just not something we've seen before. This is a different chapter. The only other country right now that's doing that kind of complex attack with those three, you know, two different types of missiles and drones is Russia in Ukraine, by the way. So they're clearly sharing tactics and sharing battlefield information. But that was absolutely an escalation by the Iranians. I mean, that is something we have not seen. We were successful in a sort of coalition way in defending Israel. But that doesn't mean this isn't a new chapter in that kind of conversation. Now, no one wants a wider regional war, but Israel has the right to self-defense. Any country has the right to self-defense. And so I think that while we want thoughtful, strategic thinking by all players, particularly the Israelis who we have a day-to-day relationship with, Because that's who we can talk to. I think we have to understand that Iran has taken this to a new place, and that was of their choosing.
It's very important context, and I hope you know we provided a lot of an overview at the top of the show, but it's important for people to understand the history and the back and forth. I did want to ask, I mean, everybody wants de-escalation, most people. There have been a number of calls over the past 24 hours from some of your Republican colleagues, including Congresswoman Elise Stefanik, who wrote on X or Twitter, whatever we're calling it these days, quote, "Joe Biden's catastrophic weakness on the world stage and his failure to support Israel, our most precious ally, emboldened Iran to launch a direct attack on Israel. As soon as Joe Biden took office, he reversed President Trump's maximum pressure campaign on Iran. And less than 6 months ago, he allowed critical international sanctions on Iran's missile and drone programs to expire, empowering Iran to launch this massive strike." There is a whole lot of revisionist history in there. It also struck me that this statement was put out on a night when, as you noted, I mean, there was a coalition of countries in the region and the United States that helped Israel defend against these strikes. So what did you make of that statement or statements that are similar to that we've seen come out from some of your Republican colleagues?
Well, I hadn't seen that statement in particular. As someone who, you know, Elise Stefanik used to work for President Bush and had a lot of different views on foreign policy until recently. Mm-hmm. I think for Trump killed Qasem Soleimani. He did a bunch of very aggressive things towards Iran, and they're still shooting at U.S. forces, shooting and providing money against Israelis. Like, that campaign didn't create the changes that they said it would create anyways. Iran is a malign actor. They are a bad mm-hmm. actor. They have been badly behaving for, at this point, you know, 30, 40 years. And it's going to take more than just one strike or one, you know, a statement from Donald Trump in order to get them to change their behavior. What I think we don't want to lose sight of is that they changed the conversation overnight. To me, it's going to take some deft, thoughtful leadership here in order to make sure we don't see this rise into something that's a tit for tat warlike situation. So, with all due respect to leaders in the other side of the aisle, the results that they say they produced with Trump's policy, I don't see them. I don't see what they're talking about. So it's to be continued. I think if Elise Stefanik wants to help her party bring the aid package to the floor of the House for Ukraine, for Israel, for Taiwan, for all of the things that we want to be able to sort of vote on and debate.
Congresswoman Alyssa Slotkin, kind of perfect place to end. There is action that can be taken to helping a lot of these countries now. I appreciate you joining me this afternoon. All of Donald Trump's efforts to delay his first criminal trial have come and gone. And this time tomorrow, he'll be watching jury selection unfold right in front of him in the courtroom. Lanny Davis is a legal advisor to star witness Michael Cohen, and he's going to join me here in studio. And later, Congressman Jamie Raskin is...
When news breaks, go beyond the headlines with the new MSNBC app.
New developments in the legal drama surrounding former President Donald Trump.
Get real-time analysis from live blogs to in-depth essays, video highlights from your favorite shows and hosts.
Lots of news of all kinds going on right now.
And the latest updates on the 2024 election.
The rematch is on. It's Trump-Biden Part 2.
Go beyond the what to understand the why. Download the app now at msnbc.com/app.
On the MSNBC podcast, How to Win 2024, political experts former Senator Claire McCaskill and Democratic strategist Jennifer Palmieri examine the campaign strategies unfolding in this all-important election.
The focus is on the voters that are not necessarily in your corner now.
If Democrats are going to win in 2024, we have to be able to explain what is happening at the border and what the solutions are.
Search for How to Win 2024 wherever you get your podcasts. New episodes every Thursday.
I'm going to weigh in as well. We're back after a quick break. Well, Donald Trump's criminal trial in New York, the first criminal trial of a former president in U.S. history, the only one of his former trials with a date on the calendar, starts tomorrow. Now, unlike a defendant who desperately wants his day in court to clear his name, if you're innocent, you typically would, Trump has thrown Hail Mary after Hail Mary to try to prevent his trial from happening. This week alone, his team filed 3 emergency appeals over the course of just 3 days. Of course, none of them worked. but we should expect more delay tactics this week. Along the way, we've also seen Trump attack nearly everyone involved in this case. This weekend, he's been up on Truth Social attacking the judge and the star witness, Michael Cohen. He's gone after Manhattan District Attorney Alvin Bragg and even the judge's daughter. Trump is clearly planting the seeds of doubt among his base so that if he is convicted, he can claim the game was rigged. But that is all simply a sideshow. And now, starting tomorrow, it is time for the actual trial. Because starting tomorrow, this case is not about the prosecutor or the judge or the judge's daughter. It is about the jurors who will be selected over the next days and even weeks in court, made up of men and women serving their civic duty. It is also about the potential witnesses, some of the people closest to Donald Trump, who saw a lot. The prosecution didn't select these people to spend time around Donald Trump. He did. And now they have been called to testify against him. Among them, of course, is Michael Cohen, who was Trump's lawyer, his fixer, his literal partner in crime, who facilitated the hush money payments at the heart of his case and then paid the price himself in prison time. He's no doubt the star witness, but importantly, he is far from the only one corroborating the story. We will likely also hear from Stormy Daniels, the former adult film star, who says she slept with Trump and then received payments in exchange for her silence ahead of the 2016 election, and Karen McDougal, the former Playboy model who alleged a 10-month affair with Trump and who was also paid to keep it quiet. And David Pecker, the former CEO of American Media, who admitted to burying negative stories about Trump to help him get elected. They are all central figures in this case, and we may hear from them very soon. And then there are also the people who are not only central to this case, and many of them will be, but people who have been incredibly close to Donald Trump himself, like Madeleine Westerhoff, Trump's former personal secretary at the White House. She was Trump's gatekeeper. I mean, he told Bob Woodward, quote, literally, Madeleine is the key to get to Trump. You had to go through Madeleine at the very time he was reimbursing Michael Cohen for those payments. And for context, I spent some time there. The person in her job has the desk closest to the Oval Office. You can see in the frame there, literally right outside the door. They see everyone who goes in and out, and they know about every conversation that happens. And then there's, of course, Hope Hicks, Trump's former White House communications director and one of his most trusted advisors for years. She was there from the jump, serving as press secretary during his 2016 campaign when he was working to catch and kill the allegations of his affairs. So Trump can attack the credibility of the DA and the judge all he wants, and he may continue to. However, his unfounded attacks are tough, given good luck trying to attack the credibility of all the people who are literally by his side every step of the way, who may also be and will likely be testifying. The trial is going to be about them, and it's going to be about a jury of 12 ordinary people. Starting tomorrow, a prospective pool of hundreds will begin to field questions until they are whittled down to a group of impartial jurors. They will decide Trump's fate. Not even really Alvin Bragg. Certainly not Judge Marchand's daughter. The jury. That is how our system works. And that is what Trump is facing starting tomorrow. Testimony from some of his closest confidants and a verdict from 12 ordinary people. Michael Cohen's legal advisor, Lanny Davis, is standing by and he joins me after a quick break. We're counting down to the start of Donald Trump's first criminal trial tomorrow in New York. And joining me now is legal advisor to the case's star witness, Michael Cohen. Lanny Davis, thank you so much for joining me on set. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
So, Lanny, we've seen this movie before. I mean, you could argue you were in the first movie, as some might say. The charges are different, but the underlying facts, of course, in Cohen's federal case back in 2018 are essentially the same facts now. Why is that? What do those parallels tell us?
Well, first, that federal prosecutors who worked for Donald Trump's Justice Department found that he directed Michael Cohen to do the crime, paying money for political reasons right towards the end of the 2016 election. That makes it a crime. Mm-hmm. The federal prosecutors in New York who worked for his Justice Department found that he directed, that's the word they used, Cohen to do the crime. Somebody who directs somebody to do a crime, that federal prosecutors say those facts are true. Of course, they have to be introduced into evidence in this trial, but the same facts must be guilty of the same crime.
Hard to imagine not, as a non-lawyer, but you're a lawyer telling me that. Trump, I just started out talking about this a little bit. I mean, Trump has been attacking everyone involved in this, including repeatedly Michael Cohen. He attacked him yesterday. It seems like it's a violation of the gag order, but I'm not the expert on that. What should Judge Merchan do in this particular case of his attacks on Cohen?
So I think the judge has handled this, as all the judges who have been attacked by Mr. Trump, by virtually ignoring and trying to impose a gag order, which is not possible.
Because Trump can't be gagged?
Well, he would be very difficult to put in jail, an ex-president. Mm-hmm. I would not favor that. So it's very hard to discipline him. Mm-hmm. But our jury system is imperfect. There may be biased jurors one way or the other. Mm-hmm. But we've lived with the jury system going back to England before we became a country. And this jury system will determine what the facts are based on the evidence. He's entitled to the presumption of innocence. As far as I'm concerned, he's innocent until 12 people say he's guilty. But the facts are the facts. And Mr. Trump has a hard time with facts. He denies facts, but he can't in a courtroom. 12 people will hear those facts.
Jury of his peers. That's how our legal system works. So I want to dig into the specifics here because you are an expert on them and familiar, and we're going to be talking about this case for the next several weeks. It is historic. Now, a key component of the DA's case is obviously Trump's reimbursement to Cohen for the payoff to Daniels, which Trump claimed were payments for legal fees. I will point out that the judge in Cohen's case agreed with federal prosecutors back in 2018 that Trump did agree to reimburse Cohen and, quote, then falsely accounted for these payments as legal expenses, essentially calling him out for his bluff, lie, whatever you want to call it there. Do you think Trump's defense team is going to try to argue this again, the same argument?
Impossible, because the facts are the facts. Number one, Trump's lawyer, Rudy Giuliani, told the truth on Fox and said they were reimbursements of illegal payments. The word illegal is my word, but they were motivated at the end of election. But Rudy Giuliani said reimbursements. Apart from that, federal prosecutors did an ample investigation, and they found in writing in a public document there were reimbursements for what they found to be illegal, politically motivated payments. And one other point, Jen, people disparage this case about sex and hush money. What did federal prosecutors say? What did the judge say? This case is about impairing democracy because allowing, this is out of their memorandum, allowing wealthy people to prevent information the American people need to vote for president is what happened here. So it's about democracy. It's not about hush money.
This is such an important point. It's holding back. It was holding back information right from the American public at a pretty pivotal time. Now, Trump has claimed over the past couple of days, yesterday, I think even, that he's willing to testify. To the point of your earlier point about the legal payments, I mean, Trump also admitted in a tweet that the payments to Cohen were actually reimbursements relating to a nondisclosure agreement. So there's a tweet for everything, as we like to say. Do you think there's a scenario where he actually testifies? And is that basically in a courtroom a gift to the prosecutors?
Let me get this straight. He said publicly, I would testify. And then someone's going to say he didn't say will testify. We saw him on Air Force One at the time that Michael Cohen was first involved in this matter saying he's just my lawyer. I don't know anything. So the record for Donald Trump telling the truth, let's hope now he's telling the truth. His supporters out there heard him say I would testify. I would say, please, Mr. Trump, testify.
You know Trump's defense team, you know this well, is going to attack Michael Cohen's credibility. Obviously, Trump started to do that. There's a lot of other witnesses here. Who's most interesting to you? Who's most impactful for the prosecution?
David Pecker. Michael Cohen's credibility was tested under the same lawyers, different lawyers, but the same Trump advocates, cross-examined in New York State Supreme Court. Brutal cross-examination. The judge heard everything and found Michael Cohen to tell the truth. So he's already passed that test. But David Pecker is a second witness. The federal prosecutors wrote that David Pecker, the publisher of National Enquirer, met, M-E-T, with Mr. Trump, and they reached an agreement. He would pay $150,000 to Karen McDougal, former Playmate of the Month, so that she wouldn't come out right before the election, so the American people wouldn't know about that affair. And Pecker said and met with Trump that Trump promised to repay him. It's a completely separate narrative that the American people are not aware of. They only know about Michael Cohen. You notice Mr. Trump has not attacked his close friend, Mr. Pecker.
He has not. That's interesting to note. So before I let you go, I wanted to ask you, I mean, prison time is on the table here. There are sentencing guidelines. And I would note that Judge Merchan said last year that he regretted agreeing to a 5-month sentence for Trump Company CFO Alan Weisselberg for tax crimes, saying he would have imposed a harsher punishment. We never know what a judge is going to decide, of course. You know that well. But is it conceivable for people watching out there that if he's convicted, Trump could go to jail for this?
He most certainly will go to jail for this because he can't pardon himself. Let me repeat this. He's going to, if he's elected president, I hope that won't take place. He says he can pardon himself and he probably will try, but he cannot
pardon. It's the state. Yeah.
He cannot pardon a criminal conviction by a jury of a state crime. He must go to jail. I would not favor putting him behind bars. I would favor a house arrest. Something less than behind bars because he's an ex-president. But there's no question he will be incarcerated either in house arrest or behind bars if he's convicted.
Lanny Davis, thank you for bringing all your knowledge about this case to us this afternoon. I really appreciate you joining
thank
me.
You.
Congressman Jamie Raskin is standing by to continue this conversation and talk about even more. We're back after a quick break. I know. We've also seen this movie before, but right now, House Speaker Mike Johnson is fighting to hang on to his gavel as the far-right flank of the Republican Party threatens to take it away. And it says a lot about the Republican Party that the one person Speaker Johnson believed could get him out of this pickle he's in is Donald Trump. It says even more about the Republican Party that the one issue they figured everyone could really rally around is what they're calling election integrity, which I'm putting in quotes because it actually means peddling conspiracy theories. That's the great unifying issue. The glue that's keeping this party together. This time, Johnson and Trump pushed a bill to keep non-citizens from voting. Now, that is already illegal, just so everybody knows, and very rare. So that should be good news to the men who are apparently so concerned about it. But of course, it's not really about this bill. It's about, once again, laying the groundwork ahead of the election to challenge the results if Trump doesn't like them. And this focus on election interference really is so rich, coming from Mike Johnson, who himself was an enabler in trying to help overturn the 2020 election. Coming from Donald Trump, who is literally going on trial tomorrow for his efforts to interfere in the 2016 election. Joining me now is Democratic Congressman Jamie Raskin of Maryland. He's the ranking Democrat on the House Oversight Committee. So I don't even know how else to start other than when you were watching, if you watched, or if you saw clips of Mike Johnson standing next to Donald Trump spouting lies about election integrity. What was going through your head?
Well, it reminded me of Kevin McCarthy's journey south to Mar-a-Lago, the $18 million palatial home Trump was bragging about, where he was on bended knee begging for Trump's support in raising money. Johnson is on life support in the House because under the MAGA rules, anybody can move to vacate the chair and basically topple the leadership just by unilateral direction. So Marjorie Taylor Greene can do it. Matt Gaetz can do it. Jim Jordan can do it. And so Trump likes having Johnson over the barrel because he controls him. And so, for example, on Ukraine aid, which is so central, Trump can keep Johnson from bringing Ukraine to the floor. We are begging Johnson to bring Ukraine aid to the floor. It would pass overwhelmingly with 60 or 70% of the votes. And so it means that Donald Trump is basically steering the bus. And of course, the person who's steering Donald Trump is Vladimir Putin. It's like Trump is the fourth branch of government and Putin's the fifth branch of government. And the Republicans can't do anything unless Trump approves it. And Trump can't do anything if his friend Vladimir Putin doesn't want him to.
Which is exactly why it's not going to be in the package currently that may move itself finally to the House this week.
We've been wanting to vote for $61 billion in aid to the Ukrainian people who are completely under the gun and outgunned, and they need artillery. And it's a very dangerous situation right now.
I'm sure you get asked this a lot. So to calm people's nerves out there who are paying attention to this and saw Mike Johnson and Donald Trump standing next to each other, I mean, there have been changes to the Electoral Count Act to put into place some important measures. But for people who are freaked out, like Mike Johnson's the Speaker of the House. He clearly is standing by Trump and is willing to help him challenge the outcome of the election. What do you tell them?
Well, first of all, Vice President Harris is vice president and not Pence or Pence's substitute. Remember, they were going to try to just oust Pence and put somebody else in there. So that helps. It's an extremely narrow majority that they have. It's basically a one or two vote majority at this point. Who knows? It could flip before then. But they would basically need to get every Republican to try to vote against a legitimate Electoral College majority and start rejecting Electoral College votes, which is what they did last time. But we're taking every permutation very seriously and preparing for all of it because, look, they tried fraud in 2020. They tried violence in 2020. They tried deceit. They tried coercion. They tried duress. They tried everything. We've got to be ready for every category of attack on the election, because we know the vast majority of the people are on the side of democracy and the Democracy Party. Joe Biden beat him by 7.5 million votes, 306 to 232 in the Electoral College. We're adding 10 or 12 million new young voters in 2024. And if we do our job right, it will be an even bigger margin in 2024. But we've got to defend the election
and protect it and prepare for it. I want to play something your colleague Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez said about her fears surrounding what a Republican majority might do after the November election. Just get your thoughts on it.
If Democrats do not retake the House in November, I do not have confidence that a Republican majority would certify the results of a presidential election. The threat of fascism is very real and very serious.
So she's clearly quite concerned about what could happen here. Does your level of concern match hers?
Well, I think we are going to win a big majority in the House. And that's, of course, who's going to be in place on January the 6th. And so that's one guarantee we've got if we can turn out the vote and win the House back. Also, the certificates of ascertainment are sent by the governors of the states and by the state legislatures that approve the popular vote in those states. We know that Trump tried to interfere both with the legislatures and the election officials like Brad Raffensperger in Georgia. But so far, those people have demonstrated respect and deference to the popular will as expressed through the Electoral College. So although eventually, and I hope soon, we'll get rid of the Electoral College and just have a national popular vote for president and elect the president the way we elect governors and representatives and senators, until then, we've got to defend every part of this antique system we've got against fraud and violence.
We only have a minute left, but you're the best framer of history in the moments we're in. So as we look to this week, a criminal trial starting tomorrow, how should we think about this moment in history?
Well, you know, Trump's people would like to trivialize and diminish the meaning of this trial. But in fact, it's perfectly emblematic of the others that are out there. They're all about electoral interference and manipulation. They tried it with violence, and we're going to see that in the DC case. They tried it with fraud. We're going to see that in the Georgia case. And here, they tried it with payoffs and then cooking the books, financial manipulation. That's what it's about. It's a very serious case, and I think the Trump people are going to be shocked how tuned in America is to what's going on here.
Congressman Jamie Raskin, thank you. Placing it in the moment of history to wrap us up. Up next, some news about what we're working on for tomorrow night's show, which will follow the first day of Donald Trump's first criminal trial. We'll be right back. That does it for me today, but we're already gearing up for a very busy day tomorrow when Donald Trump's first criminal trial kicks off in New York City. And we have a great lineup of guests joining us. Congressman Dan Goldman is going to join me. He was a prosecutor in New York and lead counsel on Trump's first impeachment. Former U.S. Attorney for the Southern District of New York, Preet Bharara, is going to join me as well, and more. That's all coming up tomorrow night at 8 p.m. Eastern.
Alpha 1-9er, commence Wi-Fi device checklist.
Laptops on. TVs streaming. Game console consoling. Smart thermostat set for cuddle time. Doorbell camera. Oh, my package is here.
Fast, reliable, able to power tons of devices inside your home at once.
All systems go, you are clear for takeoff.
This is Xfinity Internet, Wi-Fi built to wow. And watch the short film, The Aviators, now playing at Xfinity.com. Restrictions apply. Actual speeds vary and are not guaranteed.